Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Andrew Worthen from the Bexar County District Attorney's Office. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, Andrew was gracious enough to volunteer to come talk to us today about criminal appeals in the DA's office setting. And this is kind of an ongoing discussion we've been having about the criminal appellate side, which is something Todd and I don't know too much about. So we're really happy to have you here to kind of educate us a little bit about that. If you would kind of just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, kind of your background and how you got to where you are today.
Excellent. I feel kind of compelled just to do a quick disclaimer. My views are not necessarily those of the Bexar County District Attorney or the office or any other prosecutor in Texas, nor does anything I say constitute legal advice or a binding statement about any particular case or a class of cases. All right. So I got that out of the way.
We appreciate that.
You know, lawyers, we love our disclaimers.
We have one at the end of the show. It covers it too.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. But I always like to say it myself, just in case. So I was born in Phoenix, Arizona. It was a military family. So we moved all around when I was a kid. But my parents were Corpus Christi. So we always had a connection to Texas. We moved to San Antonio when I was about 8 years old. So San Antonio has essentially been my home my entire life. When I was young, I was always interested in law, politics, the Constitution specifically, history, things like that. But when I was about 19, early 20s, I got the filmmaking bug of all things, and I went to the UT Film School, and I got my degree, my undergraduate degree in radio, television, and film. And I enjoyed that. It actually uses a lot more critical thinking skills than you might imagine, kind of like being critical analysis of media and things of that nature. But towards the end of my time in film school, I always kind of had a side eye on going to law school, because again, it's something I always enjoyed. But I also met my wife around that time, or the woman who would become my wife and still is my wife. And I kind of made a decision. I said I could either go to Hollywood and try to make it for the next 20 years and not do so, or, you know, I could stay with the woman I love and go on to law school, which is something I've always wanted to do. So that wasn't really a very hard choice. So I decided to go to law school. Before I did so, I took some paralegal classes at San Antonio College. They have a paralegal program, not because I wanted to be a paralegal per se, but because they have substantive legal classes that are attorneys in the area. And so I took a criminal law class, a civil litigation class, and a legal research and writing class. And the teacher in that class just happened to be, by coincidence, the man who became my boss later on in the appellate division, Rico Valdez. And one of the assignments he had us do was a appellate brief. And I just thought that was so much fun. I really, really enjoyed that. And so whenever I went to law school, I kind of had in my mind, I was like, I'd like to do some kind of appellate class, moot court, stuff like that. So I went to law school in Washington, D.C. I figured if I couldn't go to UT law, which I couldn't because they didn't accept me, but if I couldn't go there, then I would go to law school in D.C. because I was kind of the Hollywood of law, if you will. And I went to the Catholic University, Columbus School of Law. And, you know, it's kind of not a very well-known school outside of the D.C. area, but it's like a lot of the Texas schools. You know, not a lot of people know St. Mary's outside of Texas, but within the region, it's well-known. And being in D.C., I had a lot of opportunities. I just don't think I would have had a lot of other places. So, for instance, I clerked for Senator John Cornyn on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I was able to do some internships at Maine DOJ, the National Security section of the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C., and that U.S. Attorney's Office is the biggest in the whole country. A few other federal agencies I did internships for. I interned for Judge Heidi Passichow in the D.C. Superior Court, which is their equivalent of a state trial court. I interned for Judge Alexander Williams for the U.S. Court of District Court for the District of Maryland, and I got to go see Supreme Court oral arguments. I mean, including Medin versus Texas, which is a huge case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. And so, again, it just things, I met several Supreme Court justices while I was there. I mean, it was a very fun experience to be kind of in the mecca of American law. And eventually in law school, I gravitated. Like I said, I was interested in appeals. I started to gravitate towards criminal law. So I TA'd for my criminal law professor, and I did moot court and law review and all kind of good stuff. And that's because I really wanted to, if I was going to do appellate law, I figured I'd have to clerk at some point, or, you know, I really wanted to clerk. And I actually ended up doing two clerkships, appellate clerkships. One was at the Maryland Court of Special Appeals, and that was with Chief Judge Peter Krauser. And that court, it's called the Maryland Court of Special Appeals because they used to only do criminal appeals. Now they're just like our courts of appeal, intermediate courts of appeals, they used to only do civil appeals, but now they do everything. The same thing with the Court of Special Appeals. And it was a very difficult year. One, my judge, he was a very hard man. He was kind of a perfectionist, but he warned me in the interview that he would be. So he lived up to it. But, you know, he also taught me a lot. He taught me how to work well under very fast moving conditions, because, you know, the intermediate courts of appeals in this state and in Maryland is the only intermediate court of appeals. You know, they're kind of the triage of appellate law. I mean, they get the vast bulk of appeals. And so you're having to move very quickly, but also get the law right and also write very well. And I think that's a skill that I kind of carry on today. And I don't know if I would have been as good at that without his help in developing that. But then before I was even started that job, I was offered a clerkship at the Court of Criminal Appeals with Presiding Judge Sharon Keller. And so I went to work for her, and I got to, you know, I mean, I had taken the Texas bar the year before and I'd already passed it because I always knew I wanted to come back to Texas anyway. But, you know, I get to work for her and get to learn substantive Texas law, appeals, writs, really seeing the behind the scenes of Texas's top criminal. That court is perfect for me. It's all Texas. You know, I mean, it just couldn't be a more perfect court for a Texas appellate lawyer. I'd say all appellate, but I mean, obviously writs as well. And I just want to just take a moment, if I can, just kind of give a shout out to Presiding Judge Keller. I mean, she is one of the most dedicated public servants in this whole state. I mean, she's completely dedicated to the court. She's completely dedicated to getting the law right, completely dedicated to the people of the state. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, she is the longest serving judge in the history of the court. She was the first woman on the court. And I mean, I'll just give a real quick story, if I can, about how dedicated she is. One time, we review the writs. So one of the things that the term clerks do, that all many people in the court do, we review writs that come through the office. And the thing about the writs is eventually they kind of start to blend together a little bit. So what we would normally do is we'd make little notes about them to our judge. And one day she came to me and she said, "Andrew, I noticed that there was a page missing in one of the writs, but you had not noted that." And she's like, "I want to, you know, just make sure that you really pay attention to all the writs, everything that comes in, you know, real careful with it because these are important cases." It was kind of the nicest chewing out I've ever had in my life, but I was just terrified, but she was very nice about it. But, you know, it was a teachable moment, but it kind of showed me she reads every word of everything that comes across her desk. And so I think sometimes people don't kind of give her the credit that deserves. So I just wanted to take that moment and give her the plot I wanted to give her. And so that was a big experience for me being at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. But then I eventually got hired by the DA's office, and I made it very clear in my interview. This is when Susan Reed was the DA. She hired me and I let her know. I was like, "If I can go to appeals, that would be great." And she's like, "Well, you know, we'll see what we can." But I actually started out in misdemeanor intake. And so intake division is where they put together the charging instruments and they put together the case file for the remainder of the case. Like, it's the basics. It's the beginning process of the case. And I learned a lot about, you know, just like charging instruments, stuff like that. Eventually I went to the juvenile section. Then I was in the family violence section. And then they needed an attorney in the civil division of all places for an open records attorney. And they're like, "Well, we know you want to do appeals," because I didn't make any bones about it. I told everybody who would listen to me, "Hi, I'm Andrew. I want to go to appeals." Well, they're like, "We know you want to do research, writing." This is sort of like that. So for about a year, and it was during an election year, so it was a bit stressful, they had me doing the open records. So I was the open records attorney, not just for the office, but for all the county agencies for that year. And that was a very interesting sidetrack in my criminal career. But eventually I got to go to the appellate section in about 2015. That's when they created the conviction integrity unit. And so there was some extra spaces. Now at the time, the conviction integrity unit was part of appeals. That's because appeals, used to do both writs and appeals, but then the conviction integrity unit was created. And so we kind of split off those two things. And because I had done writ at the Court of Criminal Appeals, they put me there. I always kind of joke, I think I was the very first conviction integrity unit attorney in Bexar County because I was the first person to sign there, but we didn't even have a chief yet. But I don't want to overstate what I did at that time because the whole section was in flux at that time. So eventually Jay Burden was made the chief of that section. And Jay, he's kind of known to people in the legal community because he writes a lot of legal fiction. He's a novelist, a fiction writer. And he was the director of a criminal law course recently. So you know, he had all kinds of background as a defense attorney and whatnot. He's back in appeals now. He's actually at the office right next to me. But for a time, he was the chief of the conviction integrity unit. And so we kind of, along with other attorneys, we kind of helped get that unit going. That eventually, because again, I made it well known that I really do appeals, not necessarily writs. They said, okay, well, come on up to appeals. And so that was probably about mid-2015 that I started and I'd been doing a few appeals while I was in the writ section, but I'd started doing mainly appeals at that time. And so since that time, I was adding it up the other day. I think I've done about 220, 225 criminal appeals. I've done about 170 civil appeals, the vast bulk of which are termination of parental rights cases. I've had 5 cases at the CCA, 2 of which are currently pending. I've had 2 oral arguments there. I had 2 other oral arguments scheduled, but they got canceled for various reasons. And then I have had about 4 or 5 cases go to the Texas Supreme Court, depending on how you count it. But I've never had oral argument there. We do get oral argument there sometimes. 2 of our attorneys in the last few years have, but it's rare. And that's because they usually try to get the parental termination cases done sooner rather than later. Then in 2018, I was board certified in criminal appellate law, and that's kind of been my background up to this point.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First of its kind features, like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator, expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge. You alluded to a couple of things that I kind of wanted to talk about, and I think it's how the DA's office is set up and all the things that they do, because you think about a DA's office and you think, okay, criminal, but it sounds like the Bexar County office does so much more than that.
Oh, yes. And this is true of most, at least large DA's offices, but this is true of most DA's offices around the state. So this is kind of complicated. And I actually had to look this up recently for a kind of side project that I was working on. There are 3 types of prosecuting authorities here in Texas. There's a county attorney, there's a district attorney, and there's a criminal district attorney. And all 3 of those are called for by the Texas Constitution. The county attorney is the default. If there's nothing else, there's a county attorney. The county attorney will represent the state in every matter in state court. Yeah, in court. If there's a district attorney, if the legislature have created a district attorney for that county, and some district attorneys cover multiple counties, and some of them just cover 1 county. If there's both, then the legislature will regulate what does what. So for instance, Harris County, which is the biggest county, they actually have both a district attorney and a county attorney. And the county attorney, from my understanding, and I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, my understanding is they only do civil litigation for the county government, whereas the district attorney does all the criminal work. In Travis County, another big county, the county attorney does both civil litigation for the county, but also does misdemeanor cases, whereas the district attorney does felony cases. So that's because they are separated out. They become regulated like that. Then there's the criminal district attorneys, and Bexar County is a criminal district attorney office, and they are combined. So if there's a criminal district attorney, there will never be a county attorney. The county attorney is subsumed into the criminal district attorney's office. And so that's what we are. But the main thing is, and this has been litigated at the CCA, no matter what kind of attorney you have, one of them at least has to be primarily responsible for criminal cases in the trial courts. The legislature cannot abrogate that. They can't say in Wilson County, the AG does all of the criminal cases. They can't do something like that. It has to be one of these types of attorneys that does it. So in the Bexar County District Attorney's Office, we have well over 200 attorneys. And I imagine in like Harris County, there are much more than that even. So just some of the basic setups, you know, we have our main, the bulk of our sections of is the criminal trial division. We have a family justice division that's also a very large number of cases. Our intake division, appeals, civil, juvenile, the parental termination that we call the CBS division. And I mean, I'm sure I'm missing so many, and I apologize to all the ones that I'm not naming here. But yes, the office is broken up into major crimes was another one, broken up to all kinds of different divisions. But all the criminal appeals, and again, the parental terminations too, they will go through the appellate section at some point. And so if the DA himself, the elected DA, has some kind of conflict, we will all be conflicted out. Can't wall off the DA. But if the, let's say the first assistant or me or anybody else has a conflict, we can wall that person off. The DA, we can't. And so I've actually had some appeals before. One of them was at the Court of Criminal Appeals at the time, where we had to drop the case and get another attorney on it. Luckily, with that particular case, the state prosecuting attorney was able to take it over. I believe John Messinger was on your show before. He was the attorney that took over that case for me. And so the main duty of all types of prosecuting authorities in the state is not necessarily to get convictions, but to see justice done. And, you know, that's our moral duty, that's our ethical duty, but it's also our legal duty. It's in Code of Criminal Procedure 2.01, says right there that that's our primary duty, is to not necessarily get convictions, but to see justice done. And that's something that we really take seriously in our office. I will say there's been a major sea change in prosecutors' offices in the last, God, I don't know how many years, but it's really been moving towards a, we're going to get convictions, we're going to fight to the death to always get what we want, because we wear the white hat and they wear the black hat. It's moved away from that kind of attitude towards a, we don't just win, we have to deserve to win. And I'm quoting my colleague, Paul Cho, when he told me that one, because we were talking about this recently. And I thought that was just like the perfect way to put it. That doesn't mean that we roll over on cases. In fact, one of our former DAs, I think he put it like perfectly. He said, you know, seeking justice is kind of a nebulous concept. It's like, what does that mean? Sometimes it means getting the maximum possible punishment in a case. It means getting the death penalty or life in prison. Sometimes it means not pursuing charges at all. And usually it means something in between. So it's a hard concept. And you want to make sure that whenever you're doing these cases, that you're looking at it from all angles. Obviously, our main focus is on our victims, on our communities. But I think the days of a prosecutor kind of looking over and seeing the defense attorney asleep and going, well, that's the defendant's problem, those days are over. You know, we are, you know, nowadays, that's kind of an extreme example, but, you know, nowadays the prosecutor would say, okay, judge, the defense attorney's asleep. We need to stop proceedings and see what we need to do. And just to give you a story, I was talking to our current chief of conviction integrity, Matt Howard, the other day, and he told me a story about a prosecutor who wanted to enhance a case. So you have an old conviction, you want to enhance it to a higher conviction with an old case. And when he was looking at the old case, he started to notice that there were problems. There were problems with the case, like how the plea was done and how everything was entered. And so he took it on his own accord to go talk to Matt and say, hey, y'all might want to take a look. The conviction integrity might want to take a look at this just to make sure that this is a good conviction. And Matt said that, you know, what they did was they kind of looked at it and they said, yeah, okay, there does seem to be some problems. So what they did is they contacted an outside attorney, and the outside attorney came in to represent the defendant to kind of look that over. And I just have to say that I don't think in the past, not the most recent past, but in the very distant, most, I think prosecutors would have gone, well, you know, conviction is a conviction, I'm just going to move on with it. But there has just been a fundamental shift in the thinking and process. I can't speak for every single prosecutor across the state, but I think especially the younger generation of prosecutors, they've really internalized this idea that justice, winning within the rules, is winning the right way, not just winning all the time. But again, I really want to emphasize that doesn't mean that we don't play hard if we need to. I mean, we have very vulnerable victims sometimes, and we're going to do everything we can to protect them and to protect the larger community, but we're going to do it in the right way.
You know, some of our guests, we've talked about this a little bit recently, and it seems like part of it is that science has also caught up to give a little bit more certainty, whereas before, you know, so much of it was either circumstantial or maybe based on bad science. And that seems like that's been an advance that's gone hand in hand with this.
Yes, that's very true. And the Conviction Integrity Unit, they handle what they call Chapter 64 motions, which is the DNA testing. And I believe it's new science as well. They handle those on a regular basis. And again, it used to be just the writs would be like, well, we oppose that. But now, and not always, but a lot of times, nowadays, they really take a hard look at everything. A lot of times they oppose it. That doesn't mean we roll over and everything, but The main thing is we want to, if defendant brings something to us, if they receive a letter in the mail from a family member, and it looks like there really might be something there, we get them in contact. Even if it doesn't really look, we will send some information to them just saying, hey, look, here's the Innocence Project. You can go talk to them. Here's maybe a defense attorney. I believe we have a post-conviction wheel now. A wheel is whenever defense attorneys are assigned cases. And it used to just be for the trial courts, but I believe we have a post-conviction wheel now. So something will be assigned to an attorney so they can take a look at it and they can make whatever writs that they feel are necessary to get justice. But again, justice might be upholding the conviction in that case. So it just depends on what it is. And so from the post-conviction standpoint, sometimes in appeals, we'll concede a case. We'll look at it and we'll say, okay, well, there's nothing here to argue. I mean, I can't make a colorable argument on this case. And sometimes we'll argue technicalities. If the law is on our side on that, that's what we'll do. So just to kind of give a compare and contrast of two examples, I had a case where this woman, she had been convicted. She had been put on probation. We moved to revoke her probation. She went to trial, and the trial, this is a county court, the trial judge, he would not let us put on any evidence. He did not swear in the probation attorney, probation officer. So whenever she gave her spiel, she was not sworn in, so it was not evidence. He wouldn't let the defendant put on any evidence. And the defendant said, this is not true. I'm pleading not true to this. And so this case came up on appeal, and I looked at it, and I was like, appalled. I mean, I scoured the record to see if there was anything I could argue, but I was like, no, this was just a miscarriage of justice. So I talked to my supervisor. I talked to other attorneys in the office, and we all said, yeah, there's nothing here. And apparently, this is something this judge had been doing for a while. We'll say, based on this case, reprimanded. I won't name him here, but he's been reprimanded since then. So that was a case that we conceded. Another case came through one time, and the gentleman, he had been frisked when he shouldn't have been frisked. And that uncovered a firearm, and he was convicted of being a felon with a firearm. That case came through, and I was like, looks like there's error, and it looks like there's harmful error. But he had not preserved his issue. And so I argued preservation. I did not concede that case because preservation is a systemic requirement, and it has to be followed. So that gentleman, he would have an alternate remedy. That would be ineffective assistance of counsel claim on a writ. So he would still be able to seek relief from his, but I did not concede that case because there was an argument to be made on behalf of the state. And so I made it. So I think those are two kind of examples, one where we are seeking justice following the law in a post-conviction context. And it's not always easy to kind of suss these things out. I've had cases before where I'm like, you might have to concede this, but you know what? There is an argument to be made. So I go into oral argument or writing my brief. I know I'm going to lose. I'm probably going to lose. And if we lose the Intermediate Court of Appeals, the Fourth Court of Appeals, I usually just kind of let that one die. I don't take that one up to the CCA. We made our argument. We lost. Let's call it a day on that.
Is your office ever called in terms of helping out on a matter before it goes up on appeal, like during the trial?
Oh, yes, all the time. In fact, that's one of the main things we do in appeals. So in appeals, our main duty is obviously to respond to defendants' appeals. We do PDRs. We do extraordinary matters, mandamuses. That could be an instance where we help out. We do litigation support is what I call it. And that's, you know, the trial attorneys, they come to us with a question. We have an attorney of the week program. So that's the point person. It sounds like you won a prize, but it's actually the point person in appeals. Very much did not win a prize. The point person in appeals to answer all the questions for the week. If that person's not available, obviously anybody else can help out. But we try to funnel it through that person that week so everybody's not overwhelmed. Plus, we don't like the trial attorneys to just go to their favorite appellate attorneys. We like them to kind of like speak to all of us at some point or another. So, you know, if there's a hearing that they need help on, if there is a motion for new trial they need help on, if they just have questions about jury charges, one of the hot topics right now, and I did a training on this recently for the office, is speedy trial motions. I mean, with COVID, every defense attorney is arguing speedy trial. I mean, I would do the same thing if I was a defense attorney. And obviously, we don't want to just roll over on every single case over the last year and a half. So, you know, we will help them out with those. And sometimes we judge will grant a speedy trial motion, whatever it is, and we'll do a state's appeal. But sometimes, a lot of times, actually, they will come to us, say, we need to appeal this. And we'll go, we actually don't. And we'll tell them, you know, we don't want to make bad law. This is not a good case, that the record wasn't properly developed. You didn't preserve this argument. We need to preserve our arguments just as much as the defense has to preserve their arguments. So sometimes we have to kind of push back whenever they come to us. But a lot of times, any kind of questions they have, we're always here to help them. But that's actually a really big part of what we do.
You mentioned something that I think is probably pretty unique to your office and probably a lot of big DA's offices. I imagine your office is probably the most frequent party before the Fourth Court of Appeals. So you really do have a huge responsibility in shaping the law in your appellate district, because I think you have such an outsized influence. More than civil parties, you get in, you make your law as best you can, but it really impacts your office in a way that most people don't think about.
Oh, yes. I would imagine the vast majority of, not majority, like a huge bulk of their cases are criminal appeals from Bexar County. Now, of course, the Fourth Court, I believe, is 32 counties. So they get criminal appeals from all over. But of course, we're the biggest county in that region. And the same thing would be true of Harris County, Dallas County, Tarrant County. And so, you know, we have 9 attorneys, appellate attorneys in my section. We have 3 writs attorneys, and we have ethical disclosure attorneys. So 9 attorneys for a county of about 2 million people and handling every single appeal. And again, it's not just the criminal appeals. It's also the termination of parental rights cases, which is a shockingly high number of appeals and kind of a disconcerting high number of appeals. And so we deal with a lot of like different issues that come up, and we're on the kind of the front lines. Now, you know, things go to the CCA, the state prosecuting attorney, who are fantastic, by the way. I utilize them on a regular basis, but they deal with kind of more issues that kind of come up more specialized. You know, it's, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but kind of an ivory tower. You know, they're really getting the nitty gritty of certain legal issues. We're having to deal with just the everyday line issues. And sometimes those turn out, those blow up into huge cases, and they yo-yo in the Court of Appeals sometimes. Well, I had a case of years back that went to the Fourth Court. I lost. It went down to the trial court again. It was a sentencing issue. We won again. We went back to the Fourth Court. We lost. Then I took it to the CCA, and I ultimately prevailed there. But it was an issue that we helped develop right there in the local office rather than, say, the specialized office of the SBA.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
Beyond the mandate to do justice, there are also some kind of limitations on the state as an appealing party that people don't think about. How does that impact how you handle appeals?
Well, you know, like I said, just give some history on state's appeals real quick, because I found this fascinating. I learned this when I was studying for the specialization exam. There was a case, I believe it's called Texas versus White. The defendant had appealed to the CCA. He won at the CCA. The state then put in a petition for cert at the U.S. Supreme Court. Supreme Court takes it. It reverses the CCA, sends it back down. CCA says, we're going to honor what the Supreme Court did. Good for them, right? But from now on, the state is not allowed to seek cert in any case, because this is way back in the 80s, because the state is not allowed to appeal, and a cert petition is an appeal. And I was shocked when I learned that. I couldn't believe that the CCA would tell the state that it couldn't even seek cert. That's how strict they were. But the state now has developed over the years. The state now has the ability to, I think maybe in large part because of that case, the state has the ability to appeal. But we are limited. I think there's about 10 things we can appeal. Vast majority of the things we appeal are suppression motions. They are dismissals of indictments. So a speedy trial motion will dismiss the indictment, right? So that's something we can appeal. But, you know, sometimes we don't want to appeal. So if there's a motion to quash, so let's say the prosecutor comes up to our office and he says, they quashed the indictment, we got to appeal this. And we ask them, it's like, well, hold on, can you amend the indictment to make it a more solid one? Are we within the statute of limitations? Can we re-indict this case? If there's an alternative method around going to the appeal, then that's what we want to do, because we have the ability to make really bad law. And as the appealing party, we're at a disadvantage, right? I mean, everybody knows when you're the appealer, even if it's de novo review, you're at a disadvantage. And that's true for the state as much as it is for the defense, and sometimes even more for the state, because I think a lot of times the attitude of appellate judges is just kind of like, well, state, you always win. sometimes you just lose, you know, just accept that and just live with it. You know, that's the way things go sometimes. Now, and that's what we do sometimes. A lot of times we tell our trial attorneys can't do this, or we don't want to appeal because there's all kinds of considerations. You know, we don't want to make bad law. Did you preserve error? Did you develop a record? Do we want to appeal this particular judge? Do we have a bad relationship with this judge? Do we have a good relationship with this judge? Do we trust this judge? Sometimes, though, it's just the opposite. Sometimes we have a judge that's they're granting every defense motion there is. So we have to push back on that judge. So we say, okay, we do want to appeal this judge so we can see if we can develop law. Of course, that's with a risk too, because if we lose, then they're just going to be more emboldened to do whatever they want. So again, these are considerations that we have to take in appeals. And sometimes this is just true of all the advice we give. Sometimes we have to tell them, no, we're not going to do that, or that's a bad idea. And they don't always like to hear that, obviously, but most of them, I think they trust us. Sometimes they still do what they want. And we can just have to kind of clean it up the best we can, if we can.
Not all that different on the civil side.
There's some truth to that. Y'all know it's just the trial attorney. I mean, in fairness, I'm not in trial. You know, I'm not on the ground. I'm not seeing how it is. And so they might think, I have to do this because if I don't, I'm giving away the farm for every other thing down the line. So I understand that. I'm not unaware of their limitations there. But at the same time, sometimes I wish they would just kind of slow down, think about it. And because so many problems on appeal, not just state's appeals, but even defense attorney appeals, I look at it and I go, you didn't need to do that. This just made my life so much harder. That's the job, I guess.
Well, we had Michael Falkenberg on recently. And one thing we
know him, he's awesome.
Well, thanks. We really enjoyed talking with him. And one thing that we explore with him a little bit besides writs of habeas corpus, which is, we still find fascinating, is the realm of mandamus on the criminal side. And Michael gave us, you know, so an interesting education on that. Are you seeing that in your practice, and what kind of areas are mandamus petitions taken up?
We don't do, I treat a mandamus just like a state's appeal. It's something that we got to be very cautious about. One, the standard, I understand the standard is becoming more permissive, I guess you could say. I mean, the standard stays the same, but the courts are becoming more permissive with it. That being said, you are in control of, should we take this up? And that's something I think a lot of attorneys need to stop and think, should we do this? You know, it's like Jurassic Park, you know, nobody stopped to think if they should. And so the same thing is true with mandamus. I've worked on two mandamuses myself, and we've done several others in the office, but they're rare. One, we actually got the trial court to kind of, he backed down at the last minute. He rescinded his order because I think his staff attorney, more than anybody, kind of convinced him that he should do so. But also, the mandamus was looming, and he knew that. Another one we took all the way to the CCA, and I was not the primary on that case, but I was the secondary attorney on it. And we kind of half won, half lost that case. And so was it worth it in the end? Maybe. It just depends on how you look at it. And so it was a lot of time and resources, and now we have a legal opinion out there on that issue. But it was, like I said, it was kind of half win, half loss. Did we want that opinion out there on that issue? So it's just one of those things that it's just like a state's appeal. You got to be cautious about what you got to be cautious about what you ask for. And I err on the side of caution. We have some attorneys in our section who are a little more bold. And so we have those debates among ourselves about whether what we should do. Ultimately, our chief, Mary Beth Welsh, who has been in appeals since 1997, and she's seen it all, she's done it all, she knows it all, but she's not a know-it-all. I will say that about Mary Beth. She's very, very open to hearing other people's views. Now, ultimately, she'll make the decision. Well, the ultimate decision is with the district attorney himself, Joe Gonzalez, in our office and whatever district attorney office you're in. But, you know, he greatly defers to his chief appeals, as you'd expect him to do. So, you know, we kind of have conversations among ourselves about mandamuses, state's appeals, and then she will take that to Joe and give a recommendation.
Does the way that you advocate change whether you're, you know, whether you're on the civil side of things or the criminal side of things? Because I know y'all do both.
I don't think I would say it how I advocate changes, certainly, because the vast majority of our civil cases are parental terminations. And those cases are kind of near and dear to my heart. My sister's children are all adopted. Like she has adopted them, and they all came from that foster care system. Their natural parents' parental rights were terminated. So, you know, my nephews, three of my nephews are all from that system. So I take those cases very, very seriously. And, you know, we have a lot of those, and sometimes they kind of blend into each other a little bit. So we want to make sure that you're always keeping in mind that this is a child's life. I mean, because who you're raised by, I mean, that's probably the most important thing that happens to you in your life, right? And so we want to make sure that if there's a child who was in a house and cockroaches were crawling through their hair and they didn't have any food in the refrigerator, they haven't been to school in 3 months, you know, we want to make sure that that case is upheld on appeal. In some ways, those cases are probably the most important cases that we do at the district attorney's office on a regular basis. I mean, you would say something like, you know, a death penalty case is obviously the most important case, but it's being the parental termination cases have been called the death penalty of civil litigation. And I think there's something to that because it's the ultimate like severing of ties between the parent and the child. And again, the best interest of the child is the main standard or the main thing you're looking for. So as far as advocating, I wouldn't say it changes. If anything, we're harder on, we go more hard for the civil cases than the criminal ones, because the criminal cases, sometimes you don't have a victim, say it's a drug case. And so you're more willing to say, okay, well, if I lose this case, it's not going to be the end of the world. But of course, as y'all know, sometimes the issues on appeal don't have anything to do with the type of case it is. I've had capital murder appeals where it was a mundane run of the, this is non-death penalty, this is life without parole cases. The actual type of issue on appeal is just nothing. I mean, like, but then I've had, you know, misdemeanor theft cases where it's the most brain twisting type of issue you've ever had in your life. And you're just like, how do I even start to approach this? So, so you ultimately, no, I don't approach them any differently from each other, except to keep in mind that, and this is true of all kind of criminal or civil proceedings in a DA's office, you know, you're really dealing, most of the time, you're really dealing with people's lives, your victims, your community, the defendant and parents. And those are things that you really have to, you have to have a certain objectivity, a disconnection, but at the same time, you also have to take it very seriously. And I think every once in a while you have that bad apple DA, but the vast majority of everybody I know in this office, they do.
How do you make time and take care of yourself? Because I know the stuff that you see that you've described, you see some really difficult and traumatic and hard stuff. How do you kind of disconnect from that and make sure you're taking care of yourself?
Well, I have a lot of hobbies. I'm very close to my family. I spend a lot of time with my nephews. I have a new baby niece. I have a new baby nephew. So I love them. And so I spend a lot of time with my family. I watch soccer. I'm a big soccer fan. So that's, I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm sorry. I read a lot of fiction books, non-legal writing, I guess I should say. So I try to stay mentally healthy that way. But after a while, I don't want to say we get numb to it, but there is a kind of a numbness that comes with it. What I think that's, it's like a callus you build up when you're sewing, right? It's something that's necessary to the job. You couldn't be in pain every time you went to go sew. But there are times, I mean, I think if you're really getting them to be honest, almost every single prosecutor across the state would say, there are some cases where sometimes you just kind of close the door and you take a moment. And just for me, especially, those are the cases when there's been horrific child abuse. I mean, if you get two gang members who kill each other, I mean, nobody, murder is always wrong, but I don't have the quite deep feelings for that as I do for a child who's been abused, especially if it's like some kind of sexual abuse or something like that. And so, yeah, sometimes they do. You just have to take a moment to kind of sit back. But I think that's one of the things that drives us. Again, we are there to fight for our victims, fight for our community, and we want to do it in the right way so it's not overturned on appeal. Well, we want to make sure we do our appeals in the right way so that they are not overturned. Like that case where I conceded on, and I've conceded on other cases too, but you know, that was a drug case and it was a misdemeanor case. And so conceding on that case is not going to be that big a deal. It would be very hard for me. I would really have to make sure that it had to be done if it were indecency with a child, a sexual abuse child, or anybody, actually. If that was the type of case that came in front of me, it would have to be something I'd really have to be convinced that justice was not done here and we need to concede. But that would be a big hurdle to overcome. And of course, I would have to convince my higher ups before we could ever do that.
Yeah.
If you wanted, I mean, I could talk about our specific section and the people in it.
Sure. I mean, go right ahead. I was just kind of looking back through my outline. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Go
for it. Yeah. So like I said, we have 9 appellate attorneys. So I'm just going to name everybody. There's our chief, Mary Beth. There's Scott Roberts. He's a former judge. Jay Brandon, who I told you about. There's Laura Durbin, Nathan Morey, Jennifer Brown, Stephanie Paulison, Paul Cho. That's our appellate section. There's 9 of us. So I just kind of joke that we're kind of like a CCA or a Texas Supreme Court or something like that. Then our 3 writs attorneys are, our chief is Matt Howard, who knows everything there is to know about writs. And then there's Lauren Zamora and Hank Wilkins. He's the new guy. And then we also have an ethical disclosure attorney, a specific ethical disclosure attorney in our office, who is not technically post-conviction, but she works very closely with the Conviction Integrity Unit. And her name is Caitlin McCamish. We have our two paralegals / admins. That's Shamika Roberts and Lindsay Prince. And then we have an intern who I just found out this morning. That's Ashley Huron. She passed the Texas bar. So,
well, congratulations to her.
Congratulations, Ashley.
I oversee the intern. I'm her immediate supervisor. So I was telling my coworkers, this is like I feel like a parent. I'm so proud of her. She did such a great job.
Is that, when you say ethical disclosure, is that like Brady material type disclosures?
Yes, exactly. So ethical disclosures is, again, it's part of the sea change in the office. So we have Brady material. We have the Michael Morton Act. That was a huge, huge change in how we do things. I say it was a huge change. It was a huge change for a lot of prosecutors across the state. A lot of the things that were in the Michael Morton Act, our office, I can't speak for every office, but our office was already doing those things. So open files, things of that nature, we were already doing those things in Bexar County. So she also kind of like, she keeps what we call a Brady list. And the Brady list is a list of officers or other witnesses who have certain ethical problems, and we will not call them. So if you have a case and you're a trial prosecutor, you're trying to get your case put together and you see the officer is on that list, you're forbidden from calling them. So she maintains that list. She lets everybody in the office know, hey, look, there's a new policy, a new law that's come out. In fact, Caitlin and I, just by coincidence, we were just working on a new form. It's a waiver form for certain defendants. But at the bottom of the form, it says big, bold letters. This is not just because you're waiving something right now doesn't mean that we don't have a continuing duty to disclose to you any exculpatory information in the future. I mean, that's an ongoing duty by law. I would like to think that prosecutors would do that anyway. Unfortunately, it's a law because they didn't always do it. It's like many laws. It exists because somebody didn't do what they were supposed to do. And so she actually used to be in the Conviction Integrity Unit, but she works very closely with them because, of course, one of the main claims you can bring up in a writ is Brady violations and false testimony, false evidence violations, things of that nature. So they talk to each other on a regular basis on those kind of cases.
So, Andrew, the kinds of cases you work on, many of them are what we would call high profile, high stakes. I would imagine that the DA's office gets a lot of calls from the press wanting comment. How does the DA's office handle that? I mean, are the press allowed to talk to the individual DAs, or does all the communications go through the DA? How's it handled?
In our office, we have basically a press department. I mean, I'm not exactly sure what they're called, but they're media relations. And so they're the ones who will put out any kind of statements, anything like that. I mean, individual prosecutors, they might talk, right? You know, a trial just ended. They might say a statement or something like that. Personally, I never receive any kind of like request for comments, anything or anything like that. I doubt any other of our appellate attorneys ever receive anything. I'd never even hear from victims. I mean, like in my time in appeals, I've met one victim and one victim's family. And that's only because that case got knocked down in the trial court and I was helping out in the trial process. But that case, that was the one I was talking about earlier that went back up to the CCA. And they actually, the family was very involved in that case all the way through. So that's rare for us in post-conviction. But yeah, we have a specific department that will deal with community public relations.
Well, Andrew, this has been very informative. It's been super interesting to hear about the inner workings of the Bexar County DA's office. And I don't know, I mean, we're so glad that you reached out to us about coming on and talking with us, because I don't know that we would have gotten this kind of information, seeking it out on our own. So it's super helpful to us.
It's a unique office. Again, I'm only in Bexar County, but Bexar County is very much like every other big county. And in your medium counties, you're going to have one post-conviction guy, and he's got to be kind of like the jack of all trades for everybody. And then in your small counties, it's maybe one district attorney and his assistant, maybe. And so they kind of have to fish it out to private counsel, or maybe the SPA's office will help out with them. So every office is very different. And I guess, you know, whenever y'all asked me to come on, you asked for a headshot and you asked for my web bio. And I was like, I don't have any of those things. I was like, they're going to think I'm some kind of joke. But that's just not things that we need in our practice. And there's nothing wrong with having those things by any means. Private counsel, they have to kind of market themselves. But, you know, we're not, again, this is not a pejorative, but we're just not financially driven in the DA's office. So a lot of, I mean, I'm kind of bragging on my own section here, but I would say these are some of the best appellate attorneys in the whole state. Yet nobody will almost ever know who they are because they don't get the recognition, because that's just not part of the job. You know, that's just not what we do. We just kind of, we come in, we do our job, and we move on to the next case. I mean, we have a flood of cases that we work on, and But we're happy to do it. And we love our jobs. We love representing the people of Texas and seeking justice.
Well, we're glad to hear that perspective, because you're right. We don't see enough of those kind of folks in our practices day in, day out. And what we've covered today is really, I think, a nice compliment to some of the other guests we've had on to talk about criminal appellate matters. And I guess maybe the only area that we really haven't covered there, Jody, is we haven't had like an assistant U.S. attorney or something like that on the federal side come on. So maybe that's where we go with this next.
That would be fascinating. Those guys are top notch, I'll tell you. Just my time interning, you see, I mean, I can tell you the appellate attorneys in those offices are top, top attorneys.
Well, we'll consider that for a future episode. Before we go, though, Andrew, as you know, it's our tradition to inquire with each guest about whether they have a tip or a war story to kind of help us part ways and end on. And so do you have anything for us today?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I actually have two. They're very short, though, so I won't take up too much time. Okay, so well, I had a parental termination one time, and it was ineffective assistance, which you can raise in a parental termination. And what the Fourth Court of Appeals did is they presumed prejudice. So, you know, you have to say deficient performance and prejudice, but they presume prejudice. There's a line of cases that you can presume prejudice. I didn't think they should do that, and it conflicted with another case that they had had previously. So I put in a motion for rehearing. The en banc court denied my motion for rehearing. They wrote a new opinion and they overruled their old case, the case that was good for us. So then I took that case to the Texas Supreme Court. You know, the Texas Supreme Court takes 3 years to do anything. In 2 weeks, they denied my petition. So in a few week span, I lost a case. I lost a rehearing. I got another case overturned. And then I didn't get my petition granted at the Texas Supreme Court. So that's just sometimes the lesson there is just take your L. Just, you know, sometimes you lose. Don't push your luck. My other story is the first time I ever argued at the CCA, the case, it involved whether or not the military sodomy statute was substantially similar to our Texas sexual assault statute. So you compare the elements and you see if they're substantially similar. So I was a little bit nervous, and my first argument up to the high court, and I got up there and I said, in the military, sodomy is, and then I listed everything that sodomy was in former military law, and it was kind of awkward, embarrassing moment. So the defense attorney gets up to argue. His name is Michael Robbins. He's one of the best. He's retired now, unfortunately, but he was one of the best defense attorneys I ever came up against. He was one of the public defenders here in Bexar County. And he's talking and he says the military sodomy statute. And then Judge Richardson goes, you don't have to define it for us. Everybody laughed. And I was like, okay, yeah, no, I know. I was nervous.
I can only imagine what that moment was like.
The lesson there is just be cognizant of what you're saying at all time. You know, brevity is your friend whenever you're doing oral argument. So it's not just what you say, it's what you don't say. So,
well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming on today.
Oh, no, I appreciate y'all having me on here. This is a great show, giving our office a voice on the show and all the other criminal practitioners you've been having on. I can tell you that we really appreciate all that.
That's good to hear. Thanks for being with us, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.